Greetings and welcome to the Gloucester Daily Times for Friday, August 21st, 2026, brought to you by the Talking Information Center, located in beautiful Marshfield, Massachusetts. This is your reader, George Krein. Today's lead story, less water than normal. Rockport keeps its restrictions in place. It's written by Stephen Hagen. The town ad hoc water committee is reporting Rockport's water supply is lower than normal as Cape Ann continues to experience significant drought conditions. Committee member Diane Cartwright said after meeting with public works officials, data shows the town is not experiencing any water supply issues, but that the matter needs to be monitored. Rockport gets its public drinking water primarily from two surface reservoirs, Cape Pond Reservoir, which typically holds up to 110 million gallons, and Carlson's Quarry, which holds up to 85 million gallons. Those sources are supplemented by deep rock wells in town. In terms of water levels, we're doing okay, but they're down, Cartwright said during the committee's Monday meeting. Cartwright said water levels at Cape Pond were recently recorded to be 5.7 feet versus a full level of 8 feet, and Carson's Quarry came in at 80.5 feet versus a full level of 90 feet. Rockport is considered to be experiencing a, quote, level 2 drought condition, according to the State Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs drought status map. It still shows us in level 2, which is a significant drought, Cartwright said. Another reporting method used by the towns shows the water in the town's quarry and reservoir ranges from a total volume at Cape Pond Reservoir of 66.1% and a total capacity at Carlson's Quarry of 67.2% for a combined total that averages 66.6%, Cartwright said. A year ago, the same week, it was at 72.6%, she said. It's like 6% less. Also in drought, in level two drought, our communities on the rest of Cape Ann in the northeastern part of the state on Cape Cod and central Massachusetts. The designation also applies to communities in the Connecticut River Valley region and Nantucket. Due to the current reservoir conditions and based on provisions of the Massachusetts Water Management Act, Rockport continues to implement water use restrictions. They're keeping the restrictions in place, committee member Laura Kozacek said. The restrictions are outdoor water use is limited to an odd even basis, depending on the date of the day. House addresses ending in odd numbers may water their gardens on calendar days that end in odd numbers. And house addresses ending in even numbers may water their gardens on even-numbered calendar days. Non-essential water use is banned between 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Residential well water users need to display a sign on the property visible to the street that indicates that well water is being used. Such residents also need to register their well with the Board of Health and the Department of Public Works. During the meeting, committee members considered and ultimately approved the May 4th meeting minutes. Those minutes featured ideas about improving communications between the committee and the Department of Public Works, including fostering better ties with Public Works Director Aaron Salufo and DPW Commissioner Bruce Reed. The Rockport Ad Hoc Water Committee focuses on local water supply issues and resources management initiatives. Group was formerly known as the Ad Hoc Committee on Water Supply. Public to sound off on school design. It's written by Stephen Hagen. Essex. Manchester Essex Regional School District's plans to build a new elementary school in Essex continue to evolve, and the public's input is being sought for the exterior design. Those interested in the plan's development will be able to learn more during an Essex School Building Committee community meeting next week. Superintendent Pamela Bedoin said the meeting will consider the latest draft design plans created by the firm JCJ Architecture. The focus will be to update the community on the progress made over the summer as we continue through schematic design, Bedoin said. The project team will share the latest design concepts with particular focus on several exterior design elements, and seek community feedback as the design continues to evolve. Attendees can expect to see a more developed picture of the future Essex Elementary School, she said. The meeting will take place Tuesday, August 25th at 6 p.m. at the current Essex Elementary School at 12 Story Street. Bedoin said the school building project continues to make, quote, steady progress, following approval of the preferred schematic design by the Massachusetts School Building Authority Board of Directors in June. School officials moved into the schematic design phase and have spent the summer further developing the building and site plans. School officials have selected Consigli Construction as the project's construction manager. Bedoin said the August 25 presentation will provide an update on the overall building and site design and give the community an opportunity to provide feedback, particularly on exterior design elements. The project is still in schematic design, so this is an opportunity for the community to see the work in progress and provide input as the design is refined, she said. Schematic design will continue through the fall as the project team further refines the building, site, project budget, and schedule in partnership with the MSBA, Bedoin said. The work done so far will be followed by the project scope and budget submission to be presented to the MSBA, all in anticipation of seeking approval by the regional school district's member communities of Essex and Manchester-by-the-Sea. Bedoin said a town meeting vote is anticipated in November, to be followed by a debt exclusion question to be put to voters in December. The August 25 meeting is an important opportunity for residents to see how much the project has progressed over the summer and to participate in the design process, she said. We encourage community members to attend, ask questions, and provide feedback as we continue working toward a final design for the future Essex Elementary School. In January of 2023, the MSBA recommended and approved the Essex Elementary School for admission into the eligibility phase of its grant process. Being accepted means the existing school was identified as, quote, being, again, quoting now, one of the neediest schools in the state, end quote, and a good candidate for the grant program. The MSBA grant program provides technical assistance and financial support with a minimum of 30% reimbursement for the planning and construction of a new or renovated school. In the fall of 2022, the Manchester Essex Regional School District commissioned Habib and Associates to conduct a needs assessment for the school. The results, which were reported in November 2022, indicated Essex Elementary School had passed its useful life and identified approximately $9 million in capital investments needed to simply maintain the aging facility. Poles Hill Trail work to move forward. It's written by Bobby Grady. Gloucester's Conservation Commission approved some maintenance and related work to recover the trails lost on Poles Hill during the 2022 fires following questions of who has legal oversight of the property. During the commission's Wednesday meeting, commissioners voted 3-1 in favor of Cape Ann Trail Steward's proposal for the area. The proposal, initially brought before the commission in May, includes using hand tools to scrape out the trails as well as constructing small bridges over wetlands and installing signage. Prior to the meeting, the project hit a legal hurdle when information surfaced that Poles Hill was to be managed by a specific committee established by a late 1990s management plan. The plan was created to secure a $500,000 state grant to help purchase the property. Poles Hill is a largely city-owned property located off Sunset Hill Road in the city's Riverdale section. A small portion of it is owned by the Essex County Greenbelt Association. The aforementioned management committee consisted of two members of the Conservation Commission or their designees, a member of the city's grant department, and two members of the now defunct Friends of Poles Hill Committee. What ultimately led to the legal authority questions was the fact that the Friends of Poles Hill, a nonprofit that advocated for Poles Hill and assisted in the city's purchase of it, legally disbanded in 2002, and the management committee went over 20 years without meeting. Cape Ann Trail Stewards has been conducting light maintenance on the Poles Hill trails since 2016 and reported its work to Public Works Director Mike Hale. During Wednesday's meeting, City Attorney Suzanne Egan said Poles Hill is under the, quote, care and custody of the Conservation Commission, and that the Cape Ann Trail Stewards application should not be seen as management of the property, but as maintaining the existing trails. Some folks in attendance, including former Friends of Poles Hill President Joy O'Connell, said language in the 1990s management plan dictated Poles Hill must be managed by the management group, but the commission acted on the advice of Egan and approved the project. The mayor views this as the city has the responsibility to maintain those trails, so that's who should be making decisions on them, Egan said. In terms of big, broader police issues, that's another subject matter. Conservation Commission Chair Peter Bitter asked Egan if the Department of Public Works has the authority to decide the work should be done or if such an order would have to come from the defunct management committee. That boils down to who owns the property. What does the deed say? And the deed is to the city of Gloucester, Egan said. She said that even though the property is in the care and custody of the Conservation Commission, it is maintained by the Department of Public Works. There are other properties in the care and custody of the Conservation Commission that the DPW is managing, she said. Well, it's Friday, so that means it's time for the Senior Lookout column written by Tracy Arabian. Today's headline, Keep the Memory, but Not Every Object. The just-in-case drawer, every home has one. It may be a kitchen drawer, a desk drawer, a shoebox in a closet, or a plastic bin marked miscellaneous. Its contents are familiar. Three dead batteries, two live ones of unknown age, a key to something no longer owned, a tangle of charging cords, instruction manuals for appliances that left the house during the first Bush administration, and a packet of soy sauce from a takeout meal prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is the just-in-case drawer, a modest museum of possibility. The drawer is not necessarily messy. In fact, many perfectly organized people have one. The contents may be arranged in tidy categories, perhaps in small bags or recycled margarine containers, but the governing principle is the same. I may need this someday. To be fair, sometimes we do. That small Allen wrench has been useless for 9 years until the afternoon a neighbor arrives with a wobbly bookcase. The odd little button turns out to belong to a winter coat. A manual for a coffee maker becomes suddenly essential when someone presses the wrong button and the machine begins blinking clean in several languages. These victories are satisfying because they prove that our instincts were right. We kept the thing. The thing was needed. Civilization continued. Of course, the drawer's other inhabitants have less impressive credentials. There are mystery keys that inspire elaborate stories. Surely one opens a secret lockbox, or the old garage, or perhaps the vacation cottage we rented in 1994. There are cords whose purpose cannot be identified by anyone, including the person who bought them. There is a lone earring, a bent paperclip, and a collection of rubber bands that have fused into a sticky blob. This sounds so familiar to me. We keep these objects partly because we dislike waste. Many of us were raised by people who knew how quickly a useful item could become scarce. A takeout container was not disposable. It was Tupperware with a past. We also keep things because objects hold stories. The program from a school concert may be only paper, but it recalls a child daydreaming on stage. An old keychain may summon a first car or a first apartment. The sentimental object is not really competing for draw space with a screwdriver. It is competing with the possibility of forgetting. That is why decluttering advice can sometimes sound too stern. Not every possession needs to earn its place by being practical, attractive, or useful within 12 months. A few objects are allowed to be witnesses to our lives. Still, there is a point at which just in case quietly becomes just too much. When a drawer will not close, when important papers vanish beneath expired coupons, or when one small storage spot multiplies into closets, cabinets, and pathways, it may be time for a gentle audit. Start with the easy cases, swollen batteries, dried up pens, unidentified electronics, cracked containers, manuals for long gone appliances, and keys no one can name. Then make a simple rule. Keep the memory, but not necessarily every object. Take a photograph of a sentimental item before letting it go. Save one representative keepsake instead of 20. Put the truly important things, documents, spare house keys, medication information, in a clearly labeled place, rather than trusting them to a drawer filled with flotsam. The goal is not an empty drawer. An empty drawer can feel suspiciously unprepared. The goal is a drawer that can still perform its sacred function, holding the small, odd, occasionally useful pieces of daily life without taking over the house. Keeping a few things just in case is normal. Persistent difficulty discarding possessions that creates substantial clutter or disrupts living spaces is a different concern and may warrant support. So keep the spare batteries, keep one or two containers, keep that tiny screwdriver that has saved the day, but perhaps let the 14th mystery key go. Tight Tank Rules to Get Public Airing is written by Stephen Hagen. Rockport. Proposed regulations pertaining to septic tight tanks will be the subject of a public hearing Monday, but at least one homeowner says those rules pose an economic hardship for property owners such as with such tanks. Owners of homes with tight tanks were sent a letter July 28 by Public Health Director Ray Cahill saying the hearing will take place remotely Monday, August 24th, starting at 6:30 p.m. It will be part of the Board of Health's regularly scheduled meeting, which is set to start at 6:30 p.m. But the proposed rules raise the ire of Charlie Norman of Seaview Street, just off Thatcher Road. He said the new rules will present a financial burden to him and his family. The proposed regulations are entirely unnecessary and extremely burdensome because they're based on the idea that, for some reason, tight tanks are an ecological threat to the groundwater of the town and the drinking water of the town, Norman said. The premise of this proposal is based on their concern that any variation of the water registered at the house water meter and what is eventually pumped out of the tank is somehow a threat to the town's drinking water. Norman said it costs about $500 every 7 weeks to have his tank pumped out, and the proposed rules are not necessary. During the hearing, the board plans to hear from residents about adopting the local measure to, quote, prevent and detect leakage of septic tight tank contents into the environment, end quote. Tight tanks are said to be watertight vessels having an inlet to receive raw sewage, but no outlet, and which is designed and used to collect and store sewage until it is removed for disposal. The July 28 letter indicates the measure would require septic tight tanks to undergo an initial evaluation for leaks at the property owner's expense in the interest of protecting local groundwater. 30 years after installation and every 3 years after the initial inspection. So it doesn't have to happen for 30 years until 30 years after installation and then every 3 years after the initial inspection. The proposed regulations stipulating evaluations for tight tanks include notification of the evaluation to the Board of Health by the property owner at least 48 hours in advance. All leak evaluations scheduled by the property owner must be administered by a Title V system inspector. Evaluations will be required to include documentation that the tanks plus all pipe joints that penetrate the tank shell have been inspected. Criteria used to evaluate the tank's fitness include such issues as water filtration, declining water levels or low levels inside the tank, interior dampness or other irregular discoloration, visible cracks or fissures, crumbling of walls, separation of seams or pipe joints, and such indicators as soggy ground outside the tank, foul odors, and unusually green grass in the area of the tank. In the event of a failed evaluation, property owners will be required to submit in writing a narrative of the remediation to be performed within 40 business days of the Rockport Health Department. According to the proposal, violators will be subject to a fine of not more than $100. Each day the violation continues shall constitute a separate offense. The measure indicates the Board of Health may take legal action to enforce the measure. Cahill said the regulation would not apply to properties that have a standard septic system, such as a settling tank and leaching field, or that are connected directly to the town's sewer system. Records indicate that of the 3,795 accounts on file, only 18 properties in Rockport employ the use of tight tanks. The proposed regulation reflects the town's commitment to a modern-day public health approach to protecting the environment, he said. The main goal is to protect local groundwater from contamination because aging tight tanks will eventually leak over time. Groundwater is precious because it's a vital source of what we ultimately use for drinking, bathing, and agriculture, Cahill said. We're all stewards of our natural resources, and there are significant public health implications of not living up to that responsibility. To access posted meeting agendas, you can visit rockportma.gov. Here's an editorial from the Times. Medicaid cuts will hurt those who need it most. After spending the past few years being accused of fraud and malingering, Massachusetts' most vulnerable residents now face being buried beneath a snarl of regulations and a sea of paperwork aimed at denying them the aid they need to survive. As news of just how draconian the federal government's approach to welfare has become, it is becoming clear that while President Donald Trump may not officially be on the ballot this November, his policies are. Governor Mara Healey in particular has made it a point in recent weeks to highlight her administration's response to federal policies ranging from access to abortion to climate change to health care. The governor was in Haverhill last week to launch a public awareness campaign focused on changes in federal policy that could see thousands of Massachusetts residents forced off Medicaid. The changes outlined in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill that passed through Congress last year aims to cut $1 trillion in Medicaid spending over 10 years, primarily by tightening requirements. What it did is something not beautiful at all, Healey said in Haverhill. It took $1 trillion out of health care. One way it plays out is it directly impacts those who are covered by Medicaid. She added, they are going to take that money that they save, covering people with health care, and they're going to use that to cover the tax cuts for the wealthy. It's wrong. It's going to hurt people. It's going to hurt our hospitals. And it's going to hurt the people who need help the most. By some estimates, coverage for as many as 300,000 Bay State residents will be at risk by the new year. The changes include requirements that many recipients work at least 80 hours a month, and restrictions on how much states can tax hospitals and healthcare providers to help pay for Medicaid. They added eligibility requirements for legal immigrants and more frequent, quote, redeterminations of eligibility. On the surface, they sound reasonable. In actuality, they're designed not to improve efficiency, but to bury Medicaid recipients in paperwork and then dump them from coverage when they miss a filing date or forget to sign a document. It's a burden few of us can meet if completely healthy, let alone if we're dealing with a major illness. These are the people that deserve to be on MassHealth, but because of a credible paperwork barrier the federal government is imposing, are at risk of losing the coverage for themselves and their families, said State Health and Human Services, bear with me, Secretary Kiame Mahania, formerly of the Greater Lawrence Family Center. Making things worse, the federal government has been slow to issue and explain the new guidelines, leaving the states to figure out how to implement them. The main challenge, at least in Massachusetts, is it's trying to prepare for a program it's never run on a timeline it didn't choose. Without the federal guidance, it needs to make key decisions, Dr. Rishi Wadhera, a Harvard Medical School assistant professor, told Axios. Add to that the slander recipients suffer at the hands of the Trump administration. Too many able-bodied adults on welfare are not working at all, U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy wrote in a New York Times opinion piece last year. And too often we don't even ask them to. For many, welfare is no longer a lifetime to self-sufficiency, but a lifelong trap of dependency. It's hogwash that seems lifted from the 1980s or 1990s. The last time our government truly demonized the less fortunate. The fact remains that more than 70% of adults receiving federal aid worked full time. That's according to the federal government itself, namely the General Accounting Office. Those people are voters too, and so are their friends and family members and anyone who knows someone going through tough times. Medicaid is there for all of us. If that goes wrong, people are going to be really, really upset. Matt Sallow, former executive director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors, told Axios, and that is a political firestorm that nobody wants. Moulton and Sherrill make veterans care a case for Democratic majorities. At Arlington Roundtable, Pair links veterans care gaps to broader affordability crisis. Served by Katie Castellani of the Statehouse News Service, Arlington, Massachusetts. Many veterans struggling to access health care or afford housing feel ignored by the current federal administration, U.S. Representative Seth Moulton said Wednesday, making it all the more important to him that Democrats regain control of both branches of Congress. After doing so much for our country, they're not getting the basic help and support they need in return, Moulton, a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate and a veteran, told reporters after a roundtable discussion his campaign hosted. So we obviously need more veteran voices in our policies, in our politics, and we need veterans who are actually going to get things done to fix these problems. Moulton joined New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill and 13 others Wednesday at an American Legion post in Arlington for a roundtable discussion on several issues facing veterans, including mental health and housing. The discussion also touched on how veterans are struggling to afford housing. In New Jersey, Sherrill said homelessness among veterans is at a functional zero level, meaning it's rare, brief, and non-recurring. That's largely thanks to helping veterans build communities and access other wraparound services, she said. Sherrill and Moulton also agreed that the strategies for addressing homelessness among veterans can apply to other populations struggling with housing affordability. It's very clear that not only for veterans, but and not only today, but across the country right now, the systems aren't working because affordability is a crisis, Moulton said. Thanks so much for listening. Please be sure to join us again next week for new editions of the Gloucester Daily Times. Have a great weekend, and be sure to visit our website, ticnetwork.org, where you'll find a large recorded library of newspapers, magazines, best-selling books, and classic radio plays.